the land of the rising scrum on Off the Ball.
Hello, you're very welcome along to another week of Land of the Rising Scrum, and the clock now against us. We're into the month of September, just over 2 weeks to go now until the 2019 Rugby World Cup kicks off in Japan. Today, we're going to be looking at our 17th and 18th teams since we started this journey back in May. So thanks to everybody who's tuned in so far. If you've missed any of our previous 15 episodes, you can catch the podcast at offtheball.com or the Go Loud app or any major podcast service as well. And you can also watch these back on YouTube as well, youtube.com/offtheball. And all of our rugby coverage here is brought to you by Vodafone, team of us, everyone in. Now, later we're going to be looking at Georgia. I'm going to be speaking to their head coach, Milton Haig, about what to expect from his side as they look to replicate the big improvements they made in 2015. And the big news about Mamuka Gorgodza's return to test rugby. But first, we're going to look at the last of our former World Cup winners, Australia, winners in 1991 and 1999. And beaten finalists in 2003 and in 2015, last time out in England, Michael Checa's side in Pool D alongside the Six Nations champions Wales, Fiji, Georgia and Uruguay this time round. And joining me on the line, a veteran of 62 test caps, 16 of those as captain as well, including at the 2011 World Cup, where the Wallabies came home third. James Horrible, good afternoon and thanks a million for joining us.
No worries, mate. How are you?
Not too bad now. How are you anyway, actually, because you retired from all forms of rugby there at the end of the season just gone. You're probably really only noticing, I'd say, the difference now in the last month or so when everyone would have been back at pre-season and the season would have been kicking into gear. How have you found life as a retired rugby player?
Yeah, it's been all right so far. I'm certainly not missing pre-season. So look, it's been good. You know, I'm sure there'll be times where I do miss it. You obviously miss being around the teams I've been involved in, but at the moment, all's been good. And yeah, probably not missing the hard slog of the preseason, particularly the longer one this year with the World Cup coming around.
And you obviously had a year left to run in your contract at Harlequins when you decided to call it a day. What brought on that decision? Was it just you just kind of felt the time was right?
Yeah, I think so, mate. I think you speak to a lot of people when they retire and they sort of just know. And I'd thought about it. I'd had a few niggling injuries and I guess for me it was just not – I just didn't feel that I could give what I wanted to be able to give to the team, to myself and do myself or the team justice. And when it gets to that point, I think you're better to step away because you're only going to do yourself a disservice, the team a disservice, and that's not – something that I was about as a player and as a person. And, you know, it's not forever rugby. And I knew that getting into it. And so I'm quite content that I've stepped away and now on to different and exciting things as well.
And you mentioned like you would have had a couple of kind of just niggling injuries over the last couple of years. But luckily, by the time you did decide to finish playing, you were able to go out and play those last couple of games and you finished up your rugby entirely, like playing for the Barbarians, which was obviously a great thing to be able to do. Being able to go out on your own terms, was that an important thing for you when you see the way rugby has kind of gone the last few years? So many players, injuries, you know, cutting their careers short, some players even before the age of 30.
Yeah, look, I think in the back of my mind, that was certainly there. I wanted to do it on my terms. I think you sort of try and, as you said, not everyone gets that luxury. And it's a very fickle game at times, rugby. And also, I felt that it was, I remember speaking to someone once and, you know, listening to a number of different coaches, and a lot of them said, you know, you're better to retire a year early than a year late. Mm. And that sort of terminology stuck with me. I'm like, you know, if I kept going another year, I might not be able to walk out. It might not go that well, you know, something bad. You know, I'd had a lot of injuries in my career, some very big ones that I've come back from.
And you could just lose your form as well, even. You know, people could be
exactly
looking at you saying, God, you know, James Horan, he should probably think about hanging up the boots now.
Yeah. That was sort of that as well. And I think, you know, not that that's a big part of it. And I just felt that it was time for me to move on and do something else and put my energy into something else. And as I said, probably the main ones that I didn't feel that I could do the the team and myself justice, and you know, I think that's important when you look at it. You know, you're there. It's a team game, and it's about doing your job for the team. If you don't feel you can do that to the best of your ability, then it was time for me to move on and do something else.
And what is something else? What have you got planned for, I suppose, the long term? You're still in London at the moment.
Yeah, I'm still in the UK. I've actually just recently moved to Cambridge. So I'm starting an MBA next week at Cambridge University. And so I am going to put the boots back on a little bit for the varsity match.
Yeah.
Hopefully, which is in December between Oxford and Cambridge. So, yeah, that's what I'm doing at the moment. I start an executive MBA next week. So that runs for just under 2 years. So trying to sort of upskill myself a little bit out of rugby so I can move on to the business world.
And are you heading over to Japan at all, or is this MBA taking up all your time now?
No, I'm not going to head to Japan. I looked into it and, yeah, it was going to be this next few months are going to be very busy, and I didn't think I had time to get over there, but I think it'll be a great tournament. I'm really excited. I think the Japanese will run a great tournament, and I think it'll be very, very entertaining on the rugby field and off it.
In terms of Australia, we've seen all kinds of Australia down the years. Like, I mean, in the great teams in 1991 and 99, even 2003 and 15 getting to the final, your own team in 2011 semi-final, and then 2007 quarterfinal. I might go back as far as 2007, though, because you were just kind of coming into, just kind of early in your rugby career. You'd only played one cap, I think, early on in that summer.
And yeah.
You weren't selected for the 2007 World Cup. Were you kind of, did you think you might have been thereabouts in the mix for selection, or were you just kind of at that stage of your career content to be, you know, being involved with the squad and being able to train and kind of looking ahead for 4 years' time?
Oh no! I was keen to go. I think in 2007 they only could take 30.
Yeah.
I think was the number, because obviously the front row rules were different with the reserves. So I got told by the coach I was the 31st man, which wasn't that fun at the time. They decided to take 3 second rowers instead of 4 and took a back rower as a cover, and so yeah, I missed out just for that. So look, it was you never know, things happen for a reason, and while it was disappointing at the time, as you said, I was very new in my test career, but you know, when you're a young kid and you're at that stage, you just want everything, you want it now. Patience isn't probably one of my strong points, so it was disappointing at the time, but allowed me to do some other things, work on my game, and you know, the next year was a big year for me.
Yeah, you obviously said patience isn't a strong point of yours. You obviously made a point of making improvements fast, because fast forward 4 years, not only are you in the squad, but you're Robbie Dean's captain as well. What, like, how incredible a feeling was that, not so much just to be going to a World Cup, but even to be leading Australia, to be the captain of the team?
Yeah, look, it was a huge moment for me and my family. You know, it's a huge honour to be asked to captain your country, and particularly at a tournament like, you know, the World Cup, because as we know in rugby now, you know, this is the big part of, you know, every 4 years there's a big deal, and I think it's got bigger and bigger as the years have gone on. You know, the way that teams structure their campaigns, you know, 4 years out, once this one ends, there'll be people talking already about, you know, who's going to be there for the next one, how we're going to do it. So it's a huge event, and it's getting bigger, and you know, to be asked to be in charge of a team, particularly in a country that was very close to ours, obviously being in New Zealand, our closest neighbours and probably our biggest rivals, was a huge responsibility and something that I enjoyed, but you know, didn't enjoy as much as we would have liked to get further in the competition. But that's the way it happens.
Yeah, I couldn't let you go obviously without talking about the Ireland game, and that it's obviously a game that we remember very, very well. It's clearly a game I'd say you don't remember, or you don't want to remember too well.
Yeah, look, we were outplayed on the night. I don't think there's any two ways about it. That was the Irish team just came with a greater intensity than what we did. You know, they turned over the ball. They used the choke tackle technique a lot that game, and we just couldn't get into our rhythm, and they frustrated us. And it was a game that obviously put us onto the other side of the draw. to go through. We had to go through South Africa and New Zealand to get to the final. And in the end, we fell up short. We played, you know, we put a lot of emotional energy into the South Africa game where we won, which wasn't a great spectacle, but it was certainly one for the purists.
And you got a try in that game, Dorm, am I right in saying?
I did. I think the only try.
Your only test try.
No. The only try.
Oh, the only try of the game.
For both teams, and it was a fine day, so you couldn't blame it on the weather. So it was one of those games. It was a very attritional game, and then playing the All Blacks the following week at Eden Park just didn't. They were in one of their moods that they get in when you can tell, and everything clicked for them, and we didn't play well enough, and unfortunately fell up that one short. But look, yeah, the Ireland game was a disappointing one, but we at least still had it, came with a chance to get to the final. And in a World Cup, you've got to beat everyone anyway to win it. So we just made it a little bit harder on ourselves.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, you made it hard on yourselves and how you ended up with the more difficult route. Obviously, you still ended up going further in the tournament than Ireland did. You got to a semi-final, granted you were beaten by New Zealand, but finished third. Ireland, even though on paper people would probably say they got the easier route, you know, you're beaten by Wales. And it kind of comes back to a huge thing for Irish rugby, I think, about, you know, getting beyond, for Ireland, it's getting beyond the quarterfinal. And Australia, even down the years when they probably haven't had teams as good as New Zealand or teams that you think might challenge to win the World Cup, there's just this kind of inbuilt confidence in them that, you know, they're expecting to be in the last four of a tournament, almost minimum.
Yeah, I'd 100% agree with that. I think it's a, particularly in rugby, it's very much a cultural thing that we expect, you know, we expect our team to get to at least the semi-finals. And then obviously you get to the semis, it's about showing up on the day and making sure you know, anyone can beat anyone. And I think that's where Australia's, I guess, our psyche is, and the expectation from the rugby public would be to get to the semi-final, if not the final. And that's, you know, that would be the expectation that the internally this team that are going this year would have. And I think they could get very close there. I think we've seen that their ability to perform at times has been very good. But the issue that they've had recently is the consistency. And I think, you know, if they can sort those issues out and the consistency, not only in their performance, but, you know, you need that consistency in training each week, depending on not worrying about the result. If that happens, then I think, you know, the team can go a long way. But, you know, the World Cup's a different beast. You've got to play to win it. You've got to play 7 test matches consecutively, week in, week out, which is the only time you're ever going to be able to do that in all of test rugby. So it is a big challenge, and it requires a full squad effort. And look, it can be a very intense time.
When you lay it out like that, like, you know, you're playing, if you want to win a World Cup, you're essentially playing 7 test matches one week after the other, no break. A squad at the moment, down the years, they've kind of gone up and up. We're still only at a 31-man squad. Like, for the level of intensity in rugby and the physical demands it brings, is a 31-man squad in 2019, is it a little bit too small?
It could be. I think with the way that the bench has come into play for teams now, you look at the way that it's much more of a tactical situation, the using of your bench, when probably, you know, even 5-10 years ago, it probably wasn't as tactical. It was sort of used as, in case someone gets really tired, let's bring them on. But you're seeing more and more now selections being made, you know, based on, you know, we're going to get this guy to go to start because of X, Y. And then we know this guy's going to come on at this time. So it's very much tactical. So, look, I think that's something you could look into. But you just have to see. I think it would be worth looking at, you know, what's the number? You know, is it 32? Is it 33? You know, or is it 35? I understand why they do it, because it's, you know, they want to make it a tournament. And there's probably a financial factor in there, because, you know, when you think about it, that you've got, the more numbers you have across the teams, that's more hotel rooms, more, you know, more plane tickets, all this sort of stuff. So it's there's a lot at play than just sort of saying we need more numbers because people get injured more.
And then that brings us up to 2015. You were, I suppose it's kind of unfortunate, your kind of international career is almost bookended by being the next man in a World Cup squad and you were left out. And in 2015, it was a big surprise that Michael Cheka had gone the other way and left you at home. How tough was that that news to take at the time?
Oh, look, it was. I'm not going to lie, that was very disappointing. You know, you set yourself goals. I made the decision to move over to Harlequins a long time out from the end of the year. So I'd made it sort of the year before. I knew in myself that this was going to be my last, because at the time I made the decision, there was no rule to be able to play for Australia if you played abroad. Mm. You sort of made peace with, you know, my aim is to play in Super Rugby, hopefully get selected to the Wallabies, play in the Wallabies, go to a World Cup, win a World Cup, done with my time in Australian rugby, and start a new chapter in the Northern Hemisphere. And as I said, rugby can be a very fickle beast at times, and that didn't work out the way it happened. But you know, that's rugby, and you know, you move on. And you know, it was disappointing, or you know, would have liked to, but the boys did very well in the World Cup. But I think I was quite lucky that I did have Harlequins to go play for, because you know, it gave me a completely new focus. And you know, once the decision was made, I, you know, got on the plane quite quickly to come over to Quinns and, you know, launch myself into a new chapter of my rugby career. And I think that was very beneficial for me. I think it would have been much tougher to stay back in Australia and wait there and, you know, continue with what I've been doing for the last 10 or so years.
Did you make a point at the time maybe of telling Michael Cheka, you know, I think I'll probably head over a little bit early now to Harlequins, and you know, I'm just going to be hanging around London there in case you need anything at any stage, you know.
I did mention that, you know, I sort of said that, you know, I was keen to get over there as quickly as possible, and if you need me, just you've got my number. So that was it. In the end, they didn't. So look, the boys did really well. You know, it was an exciting tournament for Australia. They did a lot better than probably people thought they were, particularly back home. And you know, once again, they probably just fell a little bit short to the arch nemesis that is New Zealand. Mm. And so it was not a disappointing time, but yeah, I enjoyed watching because I've got a lot of good friends in that squad. So it's a bit of a double-edged sword sometimes.
Yeah, and it's kind of interesting, your own situation in 2015. It's a little bit similar to what the big story of the week here in Ireland this week, which is Devin Toner being left out. You know, 60-plus test caps, you know, kind of a leader in the second row and in the line-out and things like that. And granted, the other side plot of Devin Toner's situation is that it's a project player that has been brought in and has taken his place. But, you know, someone of that experience to be left out. How does that kind of phone call go with Michael Cheka when he's delivering the bad news?
Oh, look, they never fight. It's never a nice conversation from a coach's point of view. Or, you know, you speak to a lot of coaches, and that's the hardest part of the job. But, you know, equally, it's probably the most important part of the job. And I think players just, you know, I don't know what Devin's situation was, but you just want honesty with what goes forward. And you know, in the end, sometimes coaches just have to make a decision what they feel is best from a gut feel point of view. And I think it's tough to take at the time, but you can sort of look back and go, you know, it's their neck on the chopping block a lot of the time. Most of the time, when teams don't go well, the first person to go is the coach. So he's got to make a decision, or they have to make a decision based on what they feel is best for the team to win. And so they're never nice conversations, and, you know, you can look into it and, you know, all types of ways. But, yeah, look, I'd admit it wasn't a fantastic conversation to have, particularly what was going on. And there was a few other things around from a family situation when you're trying to move overseas and trying to get all that sorted. But in the end, it makes a good story sometimes.
Is it a short conversation, or are you kind of chatting for a while? Does he kind of get straight in and deliver the bad news?
Oh, look, it's usually a pretty short conversation initially, and then you have time to process it. And I ended up speaking to him in a day or two. You know, it's sort of one of those ones that you get the news, you process it. There's nothing really you can change about it at that point in time. So you know, sometimes it's better to take a breath, recalibrate and go, okay, let's speak when I'm a bit more calm about the situation or the emotions aren't there. So I think that's something that I certainly did, is it was just, you know, look, get the information. You understand that you're not on the plane to Sydney the next day. Deal with the public, you know, not backlash or, you know, information once it's public, because then all your phone, you know, it's a funny one when you don't get selected, you get about 2 messages, and when you do get selected, you get about 50 messages. So it's always the way it's saying, when you win a game or lose a game, it's usually when you win, you get lots of messages. When you lose, usually your mum and your wife are the only 2 people that message you.
Yeah.
So it's very similar. And, you know, it's about dealing with those emotions and moving on. And the world moves in funny ways. And, you know, I think rugby is a game, you know, you can tell it doesn't stop for anyone. You know, once you finish, there's going to be more people playing for the game. So it's about making the most of the opportunities you get while you're in it.
And then, obviously, the following summer came around, and I presume in 2015, when you didn't make that World Cup squad, you probably thought you'd worn the Wallaby jersey for the last time. But the following summer came around, and England toured Australia, and you were recalled for that summer tour. I think by that stage, the now infamous Gitto Law had been passed, so your 60-odd caps, you know, were enough for you to play for Australia again. Was it important even to just, for you personally, just to be able to go back out and play one last time for Australia?
Yeah, it was nice, particularly the fact that it was in Brisbane, the test, which was my home ground, where I played all my provincial rugby, where all my family are. So that was a nice thing. I think you hit the nail on the head. I 100% didn't expect to get a phone call, and typical Michael Checker style, left it very late in the piece. I think I got an email before the Challenge Cup final. I think we were playing the day before. I got an email saying, you know, when can we have a phone call? I want to chat to you about the upcoming England tour. And I was sort of thinking, surely he doesn't want me to play. Maybe he just wants some background on, because at that stage we had about, at Queens, we had about 7 or 8 guys in the England squad. So I'm like, maybe he wants some background info on, you know, the guys like Danny Kerr, Mike Brown, Chris Robshaw, these sort of guys. So I said, oh, maybe, and then ended up having the phone call. And by the time we ended up talking, I was on holiday with my wife in Greece on a honeymoon that I'd promised her from about 18 months before. And he's like, yeah, we want you to come back and play. And so it ended up that way. So we had to postpone our honeymoon, which obviously was a tough conversation to have with the missus. But yeah, it was nice to be able to get home and have to be able to play one last time in front of your home crowd. And the tour didn't go as well as we'd have liked, but, you know, it was nice to be a part of it.
And just we're running out of time. We're one final word, I suppose. Your gut feeling, how are Australia going to do with the World Cup?
I think we'll do really well. I genuinely think we'll make it to the semi-finals, and it just would depend on who we come up with and the team that we put, you know, how we perform that day. I genuinely think that the team will lift for a World Cup. As you said, traditionally, you know, Australians do very well at World Cups. You know, we lift for the occasion. You know, we love... I think the pitches will suit our style of rugby. I think the grounds out there will be very quick. It'll be warm, so it'll be more suited to conditions to the way that, I guess, our guys are used to playing week in, week out. And I think that'll be a huge benefit to us. So, look, I expect them to do well. But, you know, the World Cup's a funny thing. There's always surprise packets. And, you know, the huge game for Australia is that Wales game, which is our second pool game. You know, we are, obviously Fiji could be a banana skin game because the talent that they've got in their squad. But obviously against Wales, who have been the number one team in the world recently, is a huge occasion for us.
James, thanks a million for joining us, and best of luck with your new ventures above in Cambridge, and enjoy the World Cup.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Now with me to look into a bit more detail about the current Wallabies crop is Christy Doran, rugby correspondent for Fox Sports in Australia and part of the Fox Rugby podcast team as well. Christy, good afternoon or good evening to where you are.
Yeah, good evening. Well, it's a good morning to you, but yes, good evening.
Thanks a million for joining us. Now, I think by the time this goes out, Australia will have already probably played their game against Samoa, their last World Cup warm-up match. So probably not much use in talking too much about that, though. But in terms of the actual team selection, have we kind of picked up much from Michael Checa's thoughts on it? Is he kind of just trying out a couple of combinations? Is there much to read into the names he's picked in that first 15?
Absolutely not. I don't think he was asked about that today, and you'd know him from your time at his time.
Yeah, he's a hard man to read.
Well, he said today, look, if I'm foxing, I wouldn't tell you. If I knew what the team was going to be like in a couple of weeks when they take on Fiji in the first World Cup match, would I tell you? No, I wouldn't either. So he was making no qualms about the fact that he wasn't going to let on too much. But the side is a radical shift from what he dished out and served up a couple of weeks ago for Bledisloe 2, which was a carbon copy from Bledisloe 1. And clearly, from what you can see, there's a lot of first-choice 15 players that aren't there, and they're clearly just being wrapped in cotton wool.
And I think not just the team selection, but in terms of the actual, performance and stuff like that as well this weekend, there probably isn't too much to read into it, given the fact that they've been out in this training camp in New Caledonia for the last week. And from the looks of things, we've seen pictures and videos of them carrying weights above their shoulders, walking up steps in a stadium.
Classic Checker, isn't it?
Yeah, we saw this with Ireland a couple of weeks ago. They'd been away doing some serious heavy work in Portugal all week, then came up against England and were, you could see it in their legs how tired they were. There's a solid chance that they could be fairly leggy this weekend after the sheer amount of work they've been doing over there. There's talk of four sessions a day at times as well.
Yeah, getting up at 6 a.m. every morning, 5:30, and then the hard slog. They're trying to replicate the conditions for the last 12 days in Noumea, yes, as you said, in New Caledonia. And there was a point that was made from Czech today when he got off the plane, which was that the programs of the players have been they're very much structured. The guys that aren't playing this weekend, it's like a mini preseason for them. They're having 2 weeks of solid weights, trying to make those little gains, whereas the guys that are playing this weekend, they would have done much more skill work throughout the last week. So clearly a few differences, but those pictures of them running up the concrete stairs at the stadiums was brilliant, and it caused a bit of a stir, because when you lose a guy like Jordan Patea inside a couple of days to a hamstring injury and he's your 19-year-old sensation, you go, okay, what are these guys doing at the moment? But clearly, we saw the benefit 4 years ago when they went over to Notre Dame in Chicago, and they all came out saying it was the fittest that they'd ever been. It was the closest the side had ever been, and so that's what they're going to try to replicate.
Yeah, you mentioned Jordan Patea there, 19 years old. He probably would have made his debut earlier if not for a bad injury that pretty much cost him all of a Super Rugby season. We were expecting he was going to be playing against Samoa this weekend, and then he picks up a hamstring injury in the training camp. First of all, there's no danger he's going to be a doubt for the World Cup at all, is there?
Well, the Australian selectors aren't giving anything away. There has to be a serious concern over him, because he was actually supposed to make his debut against Italy in Padua last November. He would have been the third youngest Wallaby behind James O'Connor, who would have been the second had he taken the field. But he tweaked his hamstring on the Tuesday before the test. Once again, he had a Liz Frank foot injury in the second round of the Super Rugby competition, and now a hamstring injury just a couple of weeks after he returns. So I would say that the reason why they've picked Tom Banks this weekend at fullback is partly because, and he was the big, like Dev Toner, he was the big omission that people were thinking, geez, I'm surprised that he's not there, because he's got pace, Tom Banks. And if Patea is ruled out, you need someone who can burn someone on the outside. And there's not a lot of Wallabies that you can say will do that to anyone in world rugby.
Mm-hmm. And there's almost, he's kind of reminding me at this age, because we've kind of seen so little of him, but we've heard so much about him. It's almost reminding me a bit in Ireland before James Ryan made his international debut, because he had been such an instrumental figure in a really, really good Irish under-20s team. And then he had gone away, he had picked up a really bad hamstring injury that pretty much cost him all of that season, what would have been his first season at Leinster. And it was coming towards the end of that campaign, and there was talk he was going to be called up for Ireland. And, you'd hear people talking about how, you know, they had seen James Ryan and how good he looked.
Yeah.
Like, it seemed that no one had really seen how good he was, or but you knew he was good and you were just waiting for it. And, you know, it turned out he ended up playing for Ireland before he even played for Leinster. But bringing it back to Jordan Pitaia, I'll be honest, I haven't seen too much of him, but I've been told this guy is incredible. How good is he? I mean, if he was going to be making his debut this time last year, he must be something special.
Yeah, he's a freakish talent, and he was the youngest ever Super Rugby player. Like, that's pretty ridiculous. You look at the guys like James O'Connor, and you think he was running out there when he was 17. Well, so would have Pitaia, but a month earlier than O'Connor, back in 2007, I think that's when he made his debut. He's a guy that is so composed in everything that he does. He's physically really well built, but clearly hasn't quite grown into his body yet, hence the hamstrings and the soft tissue injuries. But composure, he's got speed, he's so versatile. He says his preferred position is a fullback. He's mainly been used on the wing, more recently at outside centre, but he's someone that Tim Horan is immediately that you saw knew that was going to be something special. And every time he touches the ball, you go, wow, this guy's got something about him. So it would be a colossal blow, because I think, despite the fact that he hasn't made his test debut at this point, I can't see that the Wallabies would be too deterred if they were to think, let's give him the 23 jersey to take on Wales or Fiji in the first and second round of the World Cup. That's how much composure this guy's got. So time will tell, and we'll see whether or not he actually does get onto the plane and last. But hopefully, from an Australian perspective, people will see him, because he runs, he's like a horse out there. Someone called him, referred to him as running in the same sort of strides as Israel Folau. But unlike Folau, this guy can catch, he can kick, he can run, he can pass, he can do everything. So he's a special talent, no doubt about it.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to seeing a little bit more of him. It's kind of just highlights is all I've really seen on YouTube of him to date. One guy I want to talk about as well, you referenced him there a couple of times, is James O'Connor. Probably like James O'Connor 2.0, I think, is what we can probably call him at the moment. Because
3.0,
yeah, he's had so many reinventions. But you've written a lot about him recently as well, and the journey he's gone on from being the next big thing in Australian rugby to falling off the radar entirely and having to rediscover himself personally as well as professionally in his time over in Europe, to the point where he's now back at World Cup 2019. He's going to be back playing in Australian rugby next season. It's been an incredible turnaround, and it has seemed in a short space of time, but really it's been a process over the last few years.
Yeah, it has. And there's a lot of scepticism. As soon as you mention James O'Connor, you're talking to my family members and you're thinking, they all think he's a bit of a nutter, not just in terms of how he's come back and he's speaking and the change of image that he's had. But this was a guy that was going out on a Tuesday and a Thursday of a test week before a British and Irish Lions series back in 2013, going out in the town of Melbourne.
He's just tapping into the old amateur days.
we all want to return to the amateur days, don't we, at some point in time. But it's extraordinary. He comes back to France when he returned to Toulon after he didn't make the 2015 World Cup, where he came at the last minute, tried to do the Hail Mary, and he thought he was probably good enough. If I just play one season of Super Rugby, I'll come back, I'll make it. Because everything previously came very easy to him. For the first time, he started picking up a couple of injuries. His body was breaking down. There was a few other off-field issues. There was pushing and shoving with Adam Thompson, the former All Black, in the Suncorp Stadium sheds as they came back on from halftime. It was just not a happy place for him. And he went back and returned to Toulon. And Drew Mitchell says, he came back and he realised for the first time, geez, I've got to stop being a dickhead. And, you know, I'm nobody. I haven't won a World Cup like the likes of the All Blacks that he's playing alongside. And for the first time, he wasn't that big deal. He wasn't the brand that he was previously. And he credits Xavier Weld, a bloke that he ran into at a passing opportunity when he was with London Irish. And then a couple of years later, he said, look, if you want to take me seriously, then come back and give 100%. But if you're not willing to do that, I don't want to bar of you. And it took him a couple of years to work out, okay, I've actually got to turn my life around, and these are the steps I've got to put into place. But speaking to a couple of the Wallabies recently at the Qantas hangover before they went off to Noumea for their training camp, and speaking to a couple of them, and you were like, "What were the players skeptical? Were you guys thinking that, you know, this guy is seemingly talking in a way that no one's ever heard James Conner talk before?" And it took them a couple of weeks to realise that, hey, this guy has actually seemingly turned his life around. Good luck to him, because he's a good player. And everyone loves a redemption story, particularly in Australia. Mm-hmm. If you can win a Webb Ellis Cup, that is too.
Yeah. On the pitch then, over the couple of games he played this summer for Australia, how has he looked?
Three tests that he's come off, the first one off the bench against Argentina and hardly touched the ball. The second one, couldn't have had a better test match against the All Blacks. That brilliant Hail Mary pass, which set up the Wallabies' first try from, you know, left with the hand of God, that somehow ends up with Reece Hodge running 40 metres to score. But he was rather anonymous in the return Bledisloe test. And that was probably symbolic of the fact that the Wallabies forward pack was just out-muscled and out-enthused by a hungry, determined All Blacks side at their house of pain at Eden Park. And he didn't touch much of the ball. But look, he's had some great touches since returning, and Rod Kafer has been huge about it, that Australian rugby has just been too long to adapt to the idea of having a big second playmaker at number 12 and having a more skillful player at 13, probably like your Gary Ringroses or your Henry Slades. Mm. We've seen the model previously with Ma Nonu and how impressive he was for a good decade. I'm still staggered he's not in this current All Blacks side. But that's the model that Australian rugby has been very slow to adapt, particularly Michael Checker, who loved to have the Matt Giddo second ball player at 12.
Yeah, in terms of Australia in general, like, broad enough question, where are the Wallabies at the moment? Because I think over the summer, they've probably been that one team where I really just cannot put my finger on, are they a contender or are they an absolute dud? Because they've just given us everything so far this summer. Even those two Bledisloe games, 47-26 win against New Zealand, followed up 7 days later, 36-0 defeat. It really just is so hard to get a read on where they are at the moment.
And you can see the frustration and the scepticism of all the fans in Australian rugby. They hope that the Wallabies can do something, but every time that they do give you something, it's one step forward, two steps backwards with this side. But Michael Checker, over years, and you would have seen it, Ireland would have seen it with Leinster, that he was pretty close to being sacked before that marvellous European Championship victory that he achieved in, I think, his third year of coaching at Leinster. And there's the element of, don't give us a bar of hope, that we will come and we'll surprise many people. And all year, Czech has changed. He's changed considerably the way he speaks to the media, which has been very minimal. Up until this year, he's been very open. He's invited people over to his house. He's been very accommodating, and this year has just not wanted a bar of anyone. And that's probably close, because he was very close to being sacked last year. But that mentality has really shifted into the Wallabies side, and it's very much a siege mentality that they're going to be coming from miles back. They're fortunate. They've got one of the best pools for the World Cup, no doubt about it. They should beat Fiji. Wales, they've had, despite losing last year for the first time in a decade, that'll be a game that they can think that they can certainly win. And if you do that and you're coming up against Argentina or France, well, I think they would be pretty confident of a quarterfinal victory. So, you know, if you can make it into the top four, you'd be happy. But they wouldn't want to come up against England, who they haven't beaten since the 2015 World Cup, and it's been six back-to-back defeats to Eddie Jones, the Australian over there, doing a pretty good job.
Yeah, like, I mean, top of that pool looks like being, like, there is definitely a clear pathway to a semi-final there, because granted France and Argentina, you would expect, will be fighting it out for second place there, and on their day, obviously, they are very good teams, but you don't want to be playing England in a World Cup quarterfinal.
No, absolutely not, because they are everything that the Wallabies are trying to do at the moment, in the sense that their type five is massive. They've got a good scrummaging side, an excellent line out on the whole. Rolling Moore's pretty good. And then they've got a back row that's up and coming, and likes of Curry and Underhill. And then you've got Billy Vunipola. And every time Billy Vunipola takes the field, he's the best number eight in the world. So they will intimidate Australia and a lot of sides. I can't see them necessarily winning And then if you look at it, the other aspect of that, I think that Australia has probably got a significant weakness than every other international team is their goal kicking. They just can't find any goal consistency with either Christian Leilifano or Bernard Foley or Reece Hodge from 50 metres out. They all seem to be 50% kickers, really.
Yeah, and like on that as well, you mentioned Leilifano and Bernard Foley and the kicking issues. That kind of leads to, does Michael Cheka actually know what his first team is? And it's not even just does Michael Cheka know, because he's part of the selection committee now as well, which is, it's probably something that I would have thought did not go down well with Michael Cheka initially also.
You wouldn't have thought so. And Scott Johnson, who's come over from Scotland, is a man who isn't going to take a backward step either. It would be an interesting dynamic, no doubt about it. Does he know what his starting 15 is, or do the Australian selectors, the three-man panel? I think they've got a pretty good, strong idea about it. I think it's a huge indicator that Foley is playing this weekend against Samoa. Leilifano has been wrapped in cotton wool. Nick White's not playing either. You've got to remember that although that they haven't been talking about combinations and, you know, that helps, there's no doubt about Nick White, Christian Leilifano played 3 or 4 years together at the Brumbies. You don't just lose that over the night, even the fact that it hasn't been a couple of years since White's been in Australian rugby. I think those two, with White's box kicking and his organisation ability, he's a better defender than Will Genia. I think the two of them, that's one of the big criticisms over Foley, is the fact that he probably makes every second tackle. And then even when he does make the tackle, the meters that they're getting over the advantage line, because he has to just fall over them, basically. I know for a fact that there's officials that are concerned about his defensive work. Teams have been targeting him for some time there. So I think that's holding him back, and you really have to go between the two of them, because you've got Matt Tamua, who can cover both 10 and 12 off the bench.
Mm-hmm. And final thoughts as well. A couple of minutes ago, before I spoke to you, I'm just off the line with James Horrible as well, and he was talking about how, you know, he's feeling pretty confident for Australia. He thinks that, you know, ground conditions, weather conditions are going to suit them over there in Japan, and he's looking very much at last four being in contention in the final couple of games of the World Cup. What's your own gut feeling on it?
Consistency, we talked about it earlier. Well, you certainly did bring it up by not having an understanding of where this side's at. I think that they should definitely be targeting the final four. If they can beat Wales, and I expect them to beat Wales, I can't see Wales scoring enough points over knockout matches, but even at the pool stage, and no Gareth Anscombe hurts them, I think that they'll top the pool. I think if they come up against Argentina or France, they will beat them. England, I would be very concerned about. And then if you make it through to a semi-final, well, you're putting yourself into a shot. I wouldn't think they're making the final or they're winning, but I think they will definitely make the final four.
Christy Doran, thanks a million for joining us, and enjoy the World Cup.
Great to chat. Cheers.
Christy Doran there, for rugby correspondent for Fox Sports in Australia. You can also catch him on the Fox Rugby podcast team every week as well, ahead of the Rugby World Cup. And coming up next on Land of the Rising Scrum, we'll be talking to Georgia head coach Milton Haigh.
The Land of the Rising Scrum on Off the Ball.
Now, rounding off our Pool D, are Georgia ever present and rapidly improving since they made their World Cup debut back in 2003? They're now heading into their fifth World Cup. This time around, they've qualified automatically after some great performances 4 years ago in England saw them finish third place in their pool. They have had a tough task, though, if they're to repeat the third place pool finish again this time round, because they're in with Wales, Australia, Fiji and Uruguay. And joining me now, delighted to say, is Georgia's head coach, Milton Haigh. Milton, afternoon, and thanks a million for speaking to us, because I know you're probably a very busy man this afternoon. Tomorrow night, you're going to be taking on Scotland in your final World Cup warm-up match. This is probably going to be going out after that game against Scotland, so we probably won't talk too much about Friday night's match. But thanks a million for joining us today.
No, you're welcome, Neil. So my pleasure to be on the show.
I mentioned you're playing Scotland tomorrow night in Scotland, but last week was probably a big one, because you took on Scotland in Georgia, in Tbilisi. The result obviously didn't go the way you would have liked, but a huge occasion for Georgian rugby, because it was the first tier one nation to ever visit the country and play a test match in Georgia.
Yeah, no, it was. And, you know, like probably maybe the occasion sort of got the better of us a little bit, I think. You know, when you talk to the players, they certainly wanted to play well. And, you know, we'd done a fair bit of preparation, as most teams have, you know, with their preparation to World Cup. It was only our second game, and we were a little bit, cluttery, really, in terms of what we were doing, or clanky, probably more of a better description. But certainly we hope that, you know, obviously coming away from that game, we reviewed it, we've learnt a really good lesson of how Tier 1 puts pressure on you and doesn't relent on once they've got the pressure on you. And so we've done a fair bit of work around that this week, and I think coming here to Edinburgh this week is going to be a little bit better because we don't have that huge expectation that we had at home last week.
Yeah, and because, like, you mentioned the expectation, there's a bit of element of pressure as well, because rugby in Georgia for the last, you know, 20-odd years, it's been growing absolutely rapidly. We've all seen pictures of, Rugby Europe Championship games against, like, the likes of Romania and stuff, absolutely enormous crowds in Tbilisi for home games, and the atmosphere looks absolutely incredible. And it just shows, like, there really is just an untapped market around places around the world.
Yeah, no, it's just, certainly we kind of think that if you look at Eastern Europe by itself as a separate entity, the game's growing really, really quickly. Obviously, in our country, that's pretty much documented. But even in some of the other countries, you know, it's really interesting that Turkey are now talking to Georgia about how we can help them develop the game. And, you know, like, Turkey is a huge, huge country with a massive amount of potential. So, you know, you look at that country, you look at sort of obviously Russia, which is another huge country. Rugby is still a minor sport there, but growing. And even the president of the country is starting to funnel money into the development of that, of rugby as a sport in the country. So, yeah, it's got huge potential. And certainly Georgia's at the moment the shining light, obviously, because it is popular and it's the most popular game in the country. But I think as a market, certainly sooner or later, you know, the broadcasters won't be able to ignore it.
From a personal point of view, I understand you're leaving Georgia after the World Cup. You're taking up a role in Japan. Is it just nice for, on a completely personal level, that the last game you'll have played in Georgia is such an historic occasion, welcoming the first Tier 1 nation?
Yeah, no, it is. Obviously, you know, it's something that John Jeffrey and I had discussed some years ago, along with our former president of the union. JJ and I go back quite a long way, but it was nice just to you know have somebody, and somebody of Scotland too. Obviously, with my name, it's got Scottish heritage, so it was quite nice to have the Scots in town. And as you say, as a lasting memory, it's pretty cool to have been part of that historic moment. That's for sure.
And compared to when you came into the job after the 2011 World Cup, are you walking out of this role and heading off into a new job, kind of confident that you've left the position and the state of rugby in Georgia in a better state than when you picked it up?
Yeah, absolutely, Neil. I mean, I think nobody would have any doubts, especially world rugby, that the eight years that have passed since I've been here, there has been a huge shift in terms of high performance, in terms of how we run our business, the business of rugby, and then just absolute participation of the sport. I can remember, you know, if I look back at what we were when I first came here, we had, you know, virtually, you know, two or three grounds that you could play rugby. They were rugby grounds. Two or three that you could play rugby on. Now, you know, we've got at least 20 to 30 pitches around the country. So the infrastructure has grown hugely in the last 8 years. With that, the sport's grown. And then also, along with that, our high-performance abilities, not just the national team, but all our age grades and our academies, have also grown. So, you know, I can remember when we first came here, there was two coaches, and that was it, really. Myself and another guy from New Zealand, Chris Gibbs. But now when you look at the amount of full-time staff the union has, it's phenomenal.
Yeah, you mentioned the age grades, and, you know, like, particularly under 20 the last couple of years, is when I think a lot of people around the world might have stood up and taken a bit of notice as well around Georgia at the Junior Championships, because last year beating Ireland and Scotland, this year again beating Scotland, like, on the face of it, they're kind of one-off wins in tournaments, but, you know, slowly but surely that builds up to the point where you actually are being competitive. And I notice, you know, there are some names from those under 20 teams of the last 2 years that are in your World Cup squad this time around. So to be able to kind of establish something like that, where there is a conveyor belt of talent coming through that can constantly be tapped into, is obviously really reassuring.
Well, strategically for us, it's vital because, again, when you look at the long-term plan of what we're doing, the only way that we can really survive at test level is to make sure that our under 20s constantly in the Junior World Cup. So from a strategy point of view, they're fundamental to our success, really. And then when you then look at how it then practically evolves through to the national team, you know, as you pointed out, there's a few names, and I think we counted 12 members of this third squad of 10 members of this squad of 31, which is, you know, nearly a third, have come out of that team in the last 4 years. So that's how important it is for us. And again, you know, their ongoing success and their ongoing participation at the Junior World Cup is again, as I said, strategically very, very important for us.
Yeah, and in the current squad now going to Japan, like, there is a nice blend. You mentioned so many of those young players, but on the other hand, you have 18 players in the group that have World Cup experience as well. And I think most notably, I couldn't let this pass without talking about you pulled an absolute rabbit out of the hat this week. Mamuka Gorgadze in test retirement. You threw a lot of people on Monday when that came up. How did it all come about?
Well, I mean, look, we've been talking to Mamuka for quite some time, you know, over the period of 3 years, about how his body was, how he was feeling, would he think about, you know, making being available for World Cup. He's constantly came back and said, look, you know, he's nearing, I think he's got one more year in his too long contract. You know, he didn't think his body would hold up. You know, that was fine. You know, he's a magnificent man, and he's, you know, when he says something, that's it, really. But, you know, obviously, against the Kings the other night, we had two real serious injuries. One young bloke broke his leg, and our captain went off with an ACL injury, and so that put us under pressure really a bit around our positionally. Who do we replace that young player with? And also leadership wise, how do we replace our captain, in terms of knowing that he won't be available for obviously the two Scottish matches, and more than likely maybe the first two matches of the tournament. So, you know, I was asked in the changing room, Prime Minister wants to ring Mamuka to see if he'd make himself available. And I obviously said, well, if the Prime Minister feels he needs to ring Mamuka, well then let him go ahead. So, you know, and then so there was a conversation, and Mamuka obviously realised that, you know, his country needed him, and like all good Georgians, when, you know, the Prime Minister of your country says your country needs you, then, you know, he obviously couldn't say no, really, and we're very, very delighted to obviously have him in the team.
And what was the reaction around the squad when the news of that came?
Well, there was surprise, I can tell you, but a very good surprise, you know what I mean, because he hasn't played really in this team for maybe 2.5, nearly 3 years maybe. But, you know, the reality is that he's still playing well in France.
Yeah.
He's still so well respected within the squad, obviously. And you know, we've obviously watched his play in the last couple of matches, and he's playing pretty well. So, you know, obviously he's somebody that'll come in and add value to what we do. The players realise that. But I think what we've also been able to establish over the last 3 years, while he hasn't been here, is that we don't have to rely on him. And so his addition will add value to us. But again, I think the boys have sort of, in the past, we could have been a little bit reliant on him. But now we've sort of got used to him not being here, and him coming back in will just add another, as I say, another layer to what we can do.
And has his temporary retirement, I'll call it now, has that for the last couple of years given the opportunity for a handful of other guys maybe around the squad to put their hands up as kind of new leaders in the team?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's exactly what we wanted to do. We wanted to try and make sure that we took the dependency away on Mamuka. And it's not that he's like that at all, because he is such a humble and modest person. But the reality is that for a long time, everybody relied on him to do everything. You know what I mean? And so you know yourself that when you rely on one person, it's not great for the team. So, you know, again, we've been working through how we develop our leadership group, making sure that we've got younger guys in it, making sure our leaders step up. And so now, you know, with his addition, as I said earlier, he'll just bring that automatic follow me boys scenario, you know what I mean? So it'd be fantastic. Plus, he's a bloody good player. So we're happy to have him on board, that's for sure.
And, like, it is incredible looking back at Georgia's history in the World Cup. It's our fifth time going. And for Mamuka and for David Kacharava as well, yep. You know, they'll have played in four of those five tournaments. So it's almost that, you know, these couple of guys have virtually been ever present in Georgia's journey through the Rugby World Cup.
Yeah, and I think it shows just longevity in terms of their ability to keep their body right and also to stay hungry about what they're doing. You know, Kacharava's, I think he's over 110 now. He might be around that number in terms of test matches.
I thought you were going to say age there for a second.
No, you'd kill me if he's, mate. He doesn't look like that physically. I can tell you, he's a bit of a specimen. But you know, he's 31 odd, and he's, you know, kept himself in real good shape. And I remember saying in Wales in Cardiff a couple of years ago about, you know, was he interested in carrying on to this World Cup. And he said, if my body's right, well, why not? And I said, well, exactly. So, you know, like, again, as I said, these boys keep themselves in pretty good nick, and it's a testament to their professionalism, really.
4 years ago when you were in England, one of the standout names in the squad was Vasil Labanidze. He was just 18 at the time. Everyone was talking about, you know, there's this 18-year-old kid that's kind of been named in the Georgia squad. He was, I think, the youngest player ever to play at the World Cup at the time as well. And fast forward 4 years, 22 years of age now, and the experience he's had in Test rugby. I was looking through it last night, and he's at 44 caps now. By the time he gets to 50, I'm almost certain he's going to be the second youngest player ever to hit 50 caps in Test rugby behind George North. It's incredible the experience he's had over the last 4 years, and I imagine the journey he's gone on from 2015 when you picked him when he was just an 18-year-old to see him now.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, you know, he's a kid that we had a lot of confidence in back in 2015. You know, as an 18-year-old, it's a pretty big call to put a guy as young as that into a position as important as that. But, you know, like, I saw all the skill sets that you need to have a really good nine. He had good vision. He had a good basic skills of kicking and passing. And he was courageous on defence, you know what I mean? So, you know, he's developed his game as he's gone through now. You know, again, you know, ideally we would have got him into the Southern Hemisphere, to be honest, to keep him learning. But, you know, he ended up going into Brive, and he's created a bit of a career for himself at in France. But, you know, the reality is that he, as you said, he's got 44 tests. We always said to him that he could be world class, you know, if he really believed it. And for a lot of years, to be honest, he didn't. He thought we were just joking. But he's now starting to realise how fitness plays a big part in you being able to do your job at nine. And like, as I said, he's always had the skill sets, but just fitness and decision making. So, you know, again, it's still a work in progress, that's for sure. But we certainly think he's, you know, still somebody that can develop into be a really good world-class number nine.
We always hear of the scrum culture in Georgia. Everyone talks about it, just how much they love their scrums and the props they've produced down the years, like Mikhail Nariashvili and, you know, Levan Chilichava. When you've brought in someone on top of that, like Graham Rowntree, a kind of a modern-day god of the scrums and a proper ABC club member from his Leicester days as well, like, it seems that a Georgian scrum culture and him are just a match made in heaven.
That's what he'd tell you too. I mean, I remember when I first met him in London, because I wanted to, I'd heard that he was interested. So I organised the meeting in London just to catch up and be face to face, really, because I wanted to talk to him and ask him a couple of questions and see who I was, and so I could see who he was. And, you know, that meeting took an hour, and I walked out of there with our high performance manager, and I just said, mate, he's the guy for us. And And it wasn't because he was Graham Rowntree. It was because of the opportunity he felt that he was going to get coming to Georgia. And he genuinely sort of said that he was, you know, excited about the opportunity and excited about what he could do to help us. And you could feel that excitement, you know, you could, it was palpable. So, I mean, in the long run, it was a pretty easy decision for us to hire him. And, you know, it's history now, and the boys will tell you that as soon as he came, they loved him because he's a pretty grounded person. He's very passionate about, obviously, the scrum, and, you know, just his personality has gone a long way, and the Georgians have really taken them into their hearts, really. So, yeah, it's been a match made in heaven, believe me, for both parties, I can assure you of that.
Mm-hmm. And for the Munster fans that are listening here, what are they going to be expecting when Graham Rowntree comes up to Limerick after the World Cup?
Somebody doesn't mince words. but, you know, like somebody that works extremely, extremely hard. He's got very good personal discipline. He's also got a huge work ethic. And what the Munster boys will realise, and the fans, they'll realise that he's a genuine person and that he's genuinely there to help the team win matches. And so I'm pretty sure the Munster people will take him into their hearts just as the Georgian fans have into Blesey.
Mm-hmm. And another member of your coaching team that kind of slipped under the radar, I think, in the last few months is Joe Worsley. He's been involved in, is it defence, I think he's been involved in, I was reading. How long has he been with you?
Well, we came in basically for the World Cup campaign. He's a guy I met through Graham, actually, and we were over in Bordeaux November, October last year. And we were just visiting some of our players at Bordeaux-Bègle in France. And Joe was there as the defence coach at the time. And he presented to where they were in a review, team review from the game of the weekend. And we were sitting in that review and watching, and some of the stuff he did was fascinating. And I felt that here's a guy that could help us. Now, we already have a defence coach in Levan Maisashvili, who's a local Georgian coach, very good. And he's got a Saracens contact in terms of that's where he's learned some of his skill sets. But I always thought that Joe coming in could help just some of the detail on what we're doing. And so, you know, we've developed this team between Levan and Joe, and it's been working out very, very well for us. And so, you know, boys are learning, but also the coaches are learning off him, you know what I mean? So, and he's another good man who is genuinely just, you know, there to help people grow and win matches.
Mm-hmm. I was looking back through clips of the 2015 World Cup last night, and I was looking back at the win you had against Tonga in the 2015 World Cup, and there were some fantastic scenes, the celebrations afterwards. It was clearly a win that meant a huge amount to you, and you went on, and in the end you sealed that third place in the pool, and ultimately it was what, you know, guaranteed you qualification for the 2019 World Cup without having to go through the remaining qualifiers over the four-year period. Is the third place finish, is getting that qualification again for 2023, is that the primary goal for you?
Well, it's critical, really, you know what I mean? Because, again, what we can't do is we can't have, you know, like, I suppose, worse performances than last time. I suppose when you go to something, we've spent 4 years in preparing for it, and that was exactly the plan in 2015, was to get that automatic qualification, because then that gave us 4 years to prepare and plan for the one occasion that, you know, you knew you had to produce results for. So it's allowed us to do certain things in terms of those 4 years, you know, develop younger players, not worry about, obviously, qualification, play some younger guys when you probably wouldn't, you know what I mean? So, you know, and it's tested us. But I think, you know, gaining automatic qualification for us in this tournament is, again, our minimum goal, really. And if we can do something other than that, in terms of bettering what we did last time, obviously, ideally, that's what we're trying to achieve. And so, you know, I'm always trying to push the boundaries with our boys. I'm always trying to push the boundaries with the union to say, listen, that's what we did last time, but really, let's try and push the, you know, push the boundaries and try and extend ourselves to make sure that we're doing something again special, that's historic, that we've never done before.
Yeah, and setting that goal as well for 2019, like, it looks like it's going to be
even tougher than it was in 2015 to get that third place, because you've got Wales and Australia, two absolutely fantastic teams, and Fiji as well are just, you know, on their day, can just tear any team apart. There's a real kind of styles make fights approach about Fiji and Georgia, I think, shaping up. There's two real contrasting styles. It could make for a really entertaining game.
Yeah, well, I mean, look, we've played each other in the last 8 years. We've played each other three times. They beat us in the last minute in Tbilisi in 2012. Then we beat them in 2016 in Fiji. And then we lost them last year in Fiji. You know, over the 8 years, that's not a lot of times that we've played each other. We've played Tonga probably about four or five times. Look, in 2015, Tonga were ahead of us in the rankings. We'd never really beaten Tonga at all consistently. And we knew that that was going to be the game that would define our World Cup. And that's what we talked about, right? When we started the camp, you know, 3 months earlier than the kickoff to Tonga, we talked about, we had this goal, win the first game, win the last game, we qualify. You know what I mean? So that was our goal, and that's why you probably saw the emotion, because there was a lot of, you know, blood, sweat and tears that went into that victory, obviously. But we kind of think that, you know, we also had New Zealand, Argentina in the pool last time, and those two teams went through into the semi-finals. Mm. So we obviously understand who Wales and Australia are. But, you know, we're also cognizant of the fact that, you know, at times at the last World Cup, we competed with both those two teams, Argentina and Australia and New Zealand. And, you know, we're more confident in ourselves this time. We think we've got a better overall game this time. And so, you know, obviously this time you've got the bookend of the tournament, which is Wales first and Australia last. But, you know, the two middle games, Uruguay and Fiji, are absolutely our concentration. And then let's see if we can get lucky in those other two matches. Having said that, the tournament, the way that's ran and the points these days, it's going to be different, because obviously you get bonus points. So it's not quite sort of as cut and dry as winning two games, you qualify third, because it's, you know, because of those points, those, you know, bonus points. So let's see what we can do. And I think every point in this World Cup will count to people qualifying whichever way, whether it's automatically for the next tournament or for QFs for quarterfinals.
Milton Hague, thanks a million for talking to us here on Land of the Rising Scrum and Off the Ball.
Yeah, it's my pleasure, Neil. Thanks very much.
Yeah, Milton Hague there, Georgia head coach, speaking ahead of their final warm-up game against Scotland on Friday night. That's almost it for Land of the Rising Scrum. We've one more episode to come next week. Just Argentina are the only team left to go, and then we're all into the World Cup. We'll speak to you soon.
The Land of the Rising Scrum on Off the Ball.